Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, Governor Tim Walz talks about the attack on Israel, international trade, childcare, new state agencies, and more. And Education Chair Mary Kunish highlights the value of libraries and of instilling tribal perspectives in Minnesota curriculum. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. Last May, in front of a crowd of DFL leaders, committee chairs, and lawmakers, Governor Tim Walz held a One Minnesota budget signing ceremony, signaling a major shift to progressive policies and a much larger state budget that hopes to reduce child poverty, stimulate economic growth, expand healthcare access, improve education funding, invest in transportation and capital projects, and promote initiatives to mitigate climate change. But Minnesota does not operate in a vacuum, and the world is facing growing unrest in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and Asia. It is a challenging time to govern, and joining us now in the studio is Minnesota's 41st governor, Governor Tim Walz. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Shannon.
You ordered all United States and Minnesota flags to fly at half staff on all state buildings until sunset October 14th to remember, mourn, and honor the victims of the attacks on Israel by Hamas terrorists. In today's world, wars don't simply happen over there. Federal resources help support Ukraine and soon Israel, and they also aid in monitoring potential aggression against Taiwan and South Korea. When federal resources are used in world conflicts, how does that impact Minnesota's efforts to manage its own affairs?
Yeah, we're certainly not an island, and I think Minnesotans, as they woke up Saturday and across the globe, condemning the brutal attacks on innocent civilians in Israel, and it's the flowing of the flags is an outward projection of that. But we're committed that we are partners in this, and I think one of the great achievements of the United States post-World War II is keeping a world order where democracy and human rights are put at the forefront. With that being said, when these things happen, we know that our National Guard is actively involved. National Guard is no longer a strategic reserve. It's an operational force to use. We're already scheduled where our National Guard will be in Kuwait in the coming year on a rotation that was already plan. That mission obviously takes on more importance. As far as the resources that go, as a member of Congress for 12 years and someone who's looked at these federal budget issues, I continue to remind people on this that foreign aid in its entirety makes up less than 1% of our entire federal budget. But what we get out of that is the ability to be able to bring security and help with our partners, whether it be in Ukraine against Russian intervention, as in you've seen, or this idea of making sure that China's ambitions to move into a free Taiwan are kept in check. So it impacts us. We're part of this. We're good players in this. I think the message we send here in Minnesota is that we stand with our allies, we stand with our friends, and for those folks that are here, knowing that we see you, hear you, and we'll make sure we're doing all that's necessary.
You have made significant effort a significant effort to expand Minnesota's economy and culture beyond its borders, leading delegations to Japan, South Korea, Norway, Finland, and Great Britain. How reliant are Minnesota businesses and the economy on trade outside of United States borders?
Yeah, once again, this is the issue both on the human rights issue, but it's a global economy, and we do. We know our two biggest trading partners are obviously Canada and Mexico in the Northern Hemisphere, but after that, Japan in the last few years has been the largest foreign investor into Minnesota. We know there are many multinational corporations working here, and many of ours are doing business there. So part of these trade missions are working both ways. They build up friendships, they build up economic capacity together. I wouldn't say reliant, we're a major player. I think what the folks know, and we saw it in Japan, is Minnesota punches way above its weight. We're home to many Fortune 500 companies, but we're also innovators in the space around agriculture, biomedical research, and now more than ever on clean energy and water technology. So that's what we're doing. We're making sure we're out there, we're telling the story, we're showing that the investments are here, and that's why our focus on helping build a world-class workforce. We know that this is an issue plaguing a lot of countries around the world and a lot of states. Northern areas that are getting older, populations are sinking, birth rates are down. How do we make sure that we have the best qualified workforce and everybody's participating? Minnesota has a lot to brag about. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates, but we also have one of the highest labor participation rates. So that's what we're out there doing. Critically important, exciting news. We saw another $95 million investment down in Mankato from a Japanese company that is working on national defense issues. So it's exciting time.
Federal programs enacted during the pandemic to help ease budget constraints for families with children and to help support childcare services have ended. This puts greater pressure on Minnesota families, notwithstanding your administration's historic investments in child care and the expanded child care credit tax program. Will the struggle to afford early educational opportunities and secure child care services ever go away for Minnesota families?
Well, it'll always be a challenge we should address. I think the good news for Minnesotans, and you've seen some stories recently come up in this, surrounding states that weren't prepared for this, that didn't have the political will or the ability to get this done, are facing a true crisis. We knew this was coming already. We knew finding childcare is hard. Your listeners will attest to that. What that does is it shrinks our workforce and it limits opportunities for folks. And what we made this commitment is making sure that working families have the opportunity to get their child into good quality early child care. We know that when you invest in pre-K, we get $12 return for every dollar we put in. And we know with a workforce that is, again, where most of our folks are working, we have open jobs that we need to fill. And as we're innovating for the future, we need to focus on this. When we talk about making Minnesota the best place in the country to raise a family, it starts with, and it's that key. And we made no apologies about this. We focused most of our resources onto the middle class and working class folks and focused it on making life more affordable for them around child care. So it's always going to be a challenge, but I think that a lot of the folks who look into this space, Minnesota is certainly a national leader in this. We've learned from a lot of folks, and I think you're going to see the investments that we made will come back to us many-fold over.
The 2023 legislative session resulted in new state agencies and programs that are now in the process of being set up. There's the Office of Cannabis Management, there's the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and also the establishment of a paid family and medical leave program. All of these programs expected to be up and running either in 2025 or 2026. This is a huge endeavor. It creates hundreds of jobs. And as you have noted, we do have labor force issues. Does the state have the labor force to support the expansion of state government? And can this work be done both efficiently and cost effectively?
Well, the public will demand that it be done by both of those things, as they should. And I think, again, the purpose of doing this is to make sure these are programs that were highly popular for people. Paid family medical leave programs, not only a great thing to have so you don't have to choose between going and having chemotherapy and losing your job, but what we know is that loyalty to work and worker production actually increases in states that have this. So we have to make these things work. We know that there's a challenge to getting them up. The workforce, we are hiring them, but just like everyone else, everybody's looking for a limited number of employees. One of the things that we have to our advantage, I think, is people who choose to go into this work, they see public service as, you know, a calling to them, but they didn't take an oath of poverty. So I'm really proud that we were able to get some contracts that boost up, make us more competitive with the private sector. And I think one of the lessons we learned when we first came into office, we had the issue around the driver's licenses with the Minlar situation. We're using private sector to help us with this when we can. We're using innovative ways of doing things, and we'll make mistakes, which we've seen on some of these, but we're also moving in the right direction to get folks in. So I love the workforce that we have in Minnesota. Our public workers are some of the most dedicated in the country. We're seeing the numbers. We're hiring the folks that we need. And back to your final point on this, Shannon, you're absolutely right. It needs to be cost effective and it needs to work. What people want on a paid family medical leave is not to see the bill passed. They want to see when they need to collect on this, that it's a very easy process, that it's fraud proof, and that they get the money into their bank account in a short amount of time. That's what we're focused on now.
Is it your hope that with the One Minnesota budget and the investments that have been made, that people from other states and other countries will want to come to Minnesota and help our aging population, but also continue growth of the state?
That's exactly right. We're an age-friendly state. One of the things I'm most proud of is that of all the 50 states, Minnesotans stay in their homes longer than any other state, meaning we're healthier than a lot of states. We have them there. And that's exactly the point. This is a state that's going to protect your reproductive freedoms. This is a state that is going to address climate change. This is a state that values diversity and innovation. And I think we're making the case that this is a good place to live. And one of our jobs as a society and state government is to provide a healthy, well-qualified workforce and our private sector innovation, which we know, whether it's large Fortune 500s or new startups, we're seeing that start to happen. And so that's the goal, because if you sit and wait, and if we live on the past, that's not going to get there. These are industries that we used to have that are no longer there. We need to skate to where the puck's going to be, and I think that's what we're trying to do with this session.
So you've experienced the extremes during your tenure as governor thus far. Your first term was marked by a global pandemic and a divided legislature. Your second term began with the DFL majority in the legislature, the so-called DFL trifecta, and an extremely large budget surplus. That surplus enabled DFLers to make significant investments, as we've been talking about, in housing, education, clean energy, and much more. With so much accomplished in 2023, what's next for 2024?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it goes back to this. It's implementation. These are things that, again, this wasn't a wish list or this wasn't our team winning type of thing. That we know that if you have good paid family and medical leave, you have a healthier population and a better workforce. Investing in early childhood education and daycare allows more families to work. Feeding our children in school, we get better results and better test results where kids are getting universal meals. So the thing right now is, and I'm very proud of this, just this week we were awarded a national award, our tech people, for their ability to be able to quickly and without fraud get out the frontline worker checks, get out the rebate checks to people in that. Now you saw a couple of runs on that to make that happen. What I think this next session is that we need to innovate. We need to go back where we see issues where there were some glitches or whatever. Let's fix those. I think we keep investing in the infrastructure with a bonding bill, and I'm proud to tell Minnesotans, at least this far into the year, revenue projections are still staying on pace, that we have not created a deficit situation, although at the same time we've reduced taxes on about 80% of Minnesotans, whether it was removal of Social Security tax for a large number of those or whether it was a historic child tax credit. So at this point in time, the budget's balancing, it's working, Minnesotans are seeing the fruits of this, they receive checks in their mail, they'll start to see those tax reductions, and they should start to see, and I know this irritates people, a lot of construction projects getting done to improve our infrastructure, but it's happening.
Governor Tim Walz, I want to thank you so much.
Always good to be with you, Shannon.
Following a presentation by the Minnesota Department of Health, members of the Task Force on Aging continued working to identify issues that impact Minnesotans.
And I think it's important for people to realize that 40 years ago, we restrained everyone when they were a fall risk. We medicated people if they had behaviors that were agitating to themselves or others. To the right or wrong, that was the best practices as directed by doctors. And we didn't have falls, but we have not changed Alzheimer's disease, dementia disease, Parkinson's, obesity, congestive heart failure, and the list goes on. That reality has not changed. So when I look at this and I look at what's changed in 40 years, 40 years ago when I was a CNA, I didn't have falls off of a toilet. I didn't have falls from a bed because people were restrained. Now that happens.
I would argue Alzheimer's disease is the chronic condition. It is what drives and complicates all the other conditions. And the more that Alzheimer's and dementia is truly elevated as a point of emphasis at state departments of health, the better we can move all together, both in the state and beyond, towards addressing some of these really challenging public health issues related to aging.
Food insecurity and social isolation. I know in the rural areas, that's a big issue, and it's becoming more of an issue in the inner cities with volunteerism falling. The aging population is the largest volunteer population out there. How do we get the younger people involved to do community engagement?
In the rural area, we have very many, usually widows, who are living in rather large homes. And they're having trouble in some cases paying their heating bill or their taxes or their upkeep or whatever it is that costs a homeowner on a regular basis. But there is no place for them to go that is senior friendly. And therefore, the housing stock in a given community gets skewed. And so if someone from a younger person or an industry would like to come into a community, well, there's a barrier almost immediately. No housing.
the last time I spoke with Senate Education Finance Chair Mary Kunish, the Senate and the House were still working through the details of an E-12 education funding bill that would, with help from the budget surplus, boost spending by more than $2.2 billion. Senator Kunish joins me now to provide her perspective on those investments and some of the other changes stemming from the last legislative session. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
You and Education Policy Chair Steve Swedzinski visited Eden Prairie High School, Purpich Arts High School, and Red Wing Training School last week to experience firsthand the impact of some of the new education investments. What stood out to you during these visits?
Well, we were really excited to get out to those schools. We actually ended up going down to Winona and a couple other schools as well. And I think what's standing out to me is there is a certain energy because of those dollars and the investment that went into the schools that they've got to make some really good positive change. We saw and we heard that the focus on mental health is really important for our students, but it also was for our teachers. So in a couple of the schools, we saw like wellness rooms for teachers. We saw special rooms where some of the assistants for those schools were able to do the work, the paperwork and that sort of thing, the due process work for our special ed. We saw that the schools are doing the best that they can with those dollars. And of course, they thanked us very, very much for the extra dollars, but they also let us know that it isn't quite enough and that they are putting those dollars to the best use that they can, but would like to see, again, of course, more investment around classrooms, our libraries, some more resources for our students. But programmatically, it looks like things are going well.
When Governor Walz signed this education budget into law, he referred to it as the Minnesota Miracle 2.0. For those who don't remember, the original Minnesota Miracle of 1971 was known as the Fair School Financing Plan. It boosted funding for education to ease reliance on local property taxes. So Governor Walz told reporters at the bill signing that he hopes this 2023 budget and policy package will have a similar revolutionary impact on equity. Do you agree that these changes can possibly reduce the oft-cited disparities in Minnesota's educational system?
I think it's a good start. You know, when we talk about equity, it doesn't mean equal. It means that those that have those urgent needs or special needs or additional needs, those needs are being met. And we tried to do that in this bill. We tried to make sure that not only are the schools continuing to get the funding that they need, but also looking at the schools that continue to struggle, whether it's because of transportation, additional costs, heating, those sort of things. So we're going to continue to look at those issues, what it is that is bogging down the budgets of the schools, especially those that don't have a strong tax base to draw on. So there's more to be done, but I think it was a really good start. Everybody we talked to says thank you, thank you, thank you, but, and so we've been listening to that as well.
This past Monday, for the first time, Minnesota celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day as an official state holiday. As a descendant of Standing Rock Lakota, you were also the first Native woman elected to the Minnesota Senate, and you were one of the key people to bring this idea to fruition. How important is it?
This is a really important message to our Indigenous people here in Minnesota, that we hear you, we see you, we recognize you, and I think it's a really good start to understanding all of the historic things that have happened, all the federal initiatives that went into keeping our American Indian, our Indigenous people from, you know, progressing like the rest of society. And I think it's a matter of pride in Minnesota. We have 11 beautiful tribes and reservations here in Minnesota that for the first time in decades and centuries are beginning to thrive and to meet the needs of their community, their special interests. And so it was a wonderful day yesterday, filled with activities. Every hour of my day was full of activities recognizing the good work and the uniqueness of our communities. And so it was a wonderful way to share it with the rest of Minnesota.
Relatedly, ethnic studies curriculum is currently being developed for inclusion in schools in the next few years. As a part of teaching license renewal, K-12 teachers will need instruction in cultural, heritage, and contemporary contributions of American Indians, with a particular emphasis on Minnesota's tribal nations. What impact will this change have on the state and on students in particular?
I think, again, it goes back to learning the true, the real, the authentic history of our American Indian people. And, you know, when I think about all of the legislation that we passed this session that had positive effects on Indian country in Minnesota, I think there are 10 pages of it. These are kind of correcting or making better the mistakes and the things that were done to our tribes, but also not provided the same kind of resources. And so when we study about the past, we learn from our mistakes, and hopefully it helps us create policy and assistance into the communities that need it most for our Indigenous people, and so that we learn from the history. And I think it builds empathy, I think it builds commitment to our state, and certainly will broaden the knowledge base of all Minnesotans as we all learn this together.
You received the Above and Beyond Award from the Minnesota Library Association because of your advocacy in the 2023 budget to significantly improve funding for schools and regional libraries. I think it's probably an unusual journey to go from a media specialist to an education committee chair, but you have done it, and it gives you a voice to highlight the importance of libraries. So for a moment, explain why libraries are so important.
Well, for me, libraries have just always been a part of my life. From, you know, as a little girl in the village of Sartell, and the bookmobile would come out. I mean, it was like Christmas for our community. And the knowledge and the joy of reading is really so important, and it's sort of a lost art, I have to say. But libraries are really oftentimes the hub, not only of the community, but also of the school where they are providing those services. We support teachers, we support community members, we support students, and libraries build that knowledge base that we need even today. Even though we have computers and we can have information at the end of, the tips of our fingers, libraries are sort of a little community unto itself in an environment that is positive, supportive, and honestly, like, librarians will help you with just about anything. I was a reference librarian for about 3 years in Rosedale, and I remember somebody calling up and asking for a phone number to a pizza joint, and I'm like, do we have to answer that? And she's like, any question you get, we answer. And that's really the gist of what a library does.
So before we go, as you're preparing, no doubt, for the coming 2024 legislative session, which is a non-budget year, what are one or two things that you absolutely want your committee to tackle?
Well, we're hoping that there will be a supplemental budget. So maybe there are some dollars where we can do a one-time impact. But I think we will continue to look at what it is that is draining our general fund, whether it is transportation or special projects that are happening. And we're going to continue to do that work.
Senator Mary Kunish, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For more than 20 years, Roy Wilkins was the executive secretary of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The Spiral for Justice Memorial on the Minnesota Capitol grounds commemorates his work for racial equality. I spoke with retired CAP board secretary Paul Mandel about the memorial and its recent renovation. Roy Wilkins is credited with helping to achieve some of the greatest civil rights advancements in U.S. history. What else is important to know about him?
Well, he was local. He was a local hero, basically, back in those days. Worked through the law system, which is why this whole, the spiral ends up pointing towards the judicial building. Unlike Martin Luther King, who worked outside the system, Wilkins worked through the system and was working through the legal processes. So that's the main distinction point. He did go on to national repute, and of course he's got the Wilkins Center here in St. Paul and such. Between the plaque and the doors that we are interactive, it tells more about his history and what impacts and some of the quotes that he had.
What did the quotes tell us?
The quotes are sort of give you an insight into both the times that he was working with and his thoughts, because everyone knows Martin Luther King and not everyone knows of Roy Wilkins. So if you start from this end, you get a bas-relief of his face and some biographical, and then various quotes that sort of either depict the time or his work or his thoughts. Sort of his version of the I Have a Dream type thing.
What is the significance of the spiral shape and of the actual shape of the sort of pyramid type things?
I'm not quite sure if he was modeled somewhat after the Washington Monument, but it's purposely ascending as he started his work and became more and more prominent and became more and more involved. It starts off, you know, from his years of leadership, basically markers in time that where he was struggling and not getting anywhere. And then as the pieces rise, he's getting more and more influence and getting more and more known and having more and more success, to the point when in the final end, it all points to the judicial center with the reliquary at the end point.
What about the flooring around the spirals? What is that supposed to represent?
It's all representative of African either symbols or patterns, sort of like the Hmong flooring is very, very representative of their designs. But it's repetitive, and it's purposely chained off because in the winter it gets very slippery with the ice, and bronze also heats up, so it gets a lot of sun and a lot of heating, which is why we have wood benches. They're actually wood coverings, because the bronze benches, when we first had them, some people got actually hurt by sitting on them in the middle of the summer.
Oh, ouch.
So we put some teak wood on top of them.
The memorial recently underwent a renovation. What had happened to it over time, and what needed to be done to restore it?
This is all bronze, and the first patination job had been done under extreme weather conditions, and it really didn't take well, and then it had been vandalized over time. The doors had all been broken, either accidentally or intentionally, so some of them were always open, some of them wouldn't open, or some of them were dangerous when they open and shut, so because they're on fulcrums. It needed complete stripping down and a repatination. So we chose the color based on the original intent, which was sort of a warm, light bronze. And so they stripped it all down, repatinated it, and then waxed it all so it would stay like this.
So it won't change color over time?
So it won't change color over time. It won't become the green that we see copper happening.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.